Chapter 10, A Different World, Ramiq.
My freshman year at Seton Hall was like living in a foreign country where few people looked like me or spoke my language, and the trouble started right away. I had been on campus just a half a semester when I invited my stepbrother Michael to visit me. I called him my stepbrother, but he was really the son of my father's longtime girlfriend. Michael had dropped out of high school, and I hoped that exposing him to college would encourage him to return. In elementary school, he had been a smart kid who made straight A's, wore glasses, and loved to read. The kids at school, in his neighborhood, and even his family had called him a nerd and teased him. I teased him too, but as we got older, I felt bad for him. I knew he was a good guy, and I could see the teasing was really bothering him. His grades fell. He began hanging out with troublemakers and eventually just stopped going to school. He began working out in the gym and transform his once scrawny frame into muscles and mass. Before long, he was getting into trouble too. He accepted the invitation to visit me at Seton Hall, and he brought one of his cousins and another friend with him. They ran wild on campus all day. About 1 o'clock the next morning, they were still at it, making too much noise in Bowling Hall, the freshman dormitory where I lived. I was afraid they would get us all in trouble, so I confronted Michael in the hall outside my room on the third floor. He accused me of making a big deal out of nothing. My temper blew, and we began arguing loudly, as though we were about to fight. A crowd of students gathered around us, ready to watch some kind of showdown. All of a sudden, I looked up and I saw a bunch of white faces staring at us. I felt ashamed. We were a spectacle, confirming white people's worst stereotypes. Most of my encounters with white people at that point in my life had been negative. White sales clerks followed me through the store on shopping trips through the mall, white police officers stopping and harassing me on the streets of my neighborhood, white passengers holding onto their purses a bit tighter on the train when I passed them. To the average white stranger, I was an instant security threat, a thug, an object to be loathed or feared, not a human being with a heart and dreams and family and fears. I resented this stereotype, but instead of calming myself down, I turned my anger on the crowd. "Why don't y'all get away from here?" I shouted. "We're just having a little disagreement. This ain't nothing for y'all. We ain't no spectacle." The crowd dispersed, all but two white guys, who continued to stare. One of them wore an arrogant smirk. "Y'all didn't hear what I said?" I yelled. "I said leave." The one with the smirk stood his ground. "Well, we live on this floor too. We pay tuition too, and we don't have to go anywhere." My anger rose another notch. "Did you say?" I asked, feigning disbelief, staring him in his eyes, trying to intimidate him to back down. He repeated himself, full of that righteous white boy attitude. Now my stepbrother and his boys were looking at me as if to say, "Man, this white boy is getting the best of you. What are you going to do?" If I did nothing, I'd look like a punk. I walked over to him and stood chest to chest. "Look, I'm counting to three. If you don't leave, you're going to wish you had." The white boy chuckled a bit in my face and then turned to his partner. "He's trying to threaten us. Like I really care." I couldn't believe this white boy was disrespecting me. Mind you, he was right. He had as much claim to the hallway space as I had, and I had no business ordering him to his room. But my mind was too filled with anger to accept a rational thought. All I saw was an arrogant white boy trying to put a nigger in his place. I slowly counted to three. The white boy didn't move. With a strength that belied my small frame, I grabbed him simultaneously by his collar and his crotch, raised him over my head, and dropped him. He slammed to the floor, head first. His neck bent in an odd way, and his body fell limp. Fear replaced my anger. For a few seconds, all I could hear was my heart thumping wildly. I thought I had paralyzed or killed the guy. Suddenly, he moved. I exhaled. But with my stepbrother and his boys watching, I couldn't drop my tough guy demeanor. "Now get up," I commanded. The boy was silent. His friend helped him up, and he limped away. I turned and walked past my stepbrother and his boys to my room. I fell on my bed. Sam was out that night, and George was across the hall in his suite. I lay in my room alone, thinking to myself over and over, "Man, what have you done? What have you gotten yourself into now?" About 4 a.m., loud banging on the door of my suite broke my sleep. "South Orange Police," a voice yelled from the other side. They had come for me. I resigned myself to what was sure to happen next. The white boy would press charges against me. I would get kicked out of school, and for what? Because the white boy didn't leave when I told him to leave? I was wrong, and I knew it. I just wasn't thinking about the consequences. On the streets where I grew up, you didn't worry about consequences. If someone disrespected you, you beat his ass, period. From the time I was a little boy, my mother had warned me never to come home crying because I was scared to fight back when someone picked on me. "If you don't beat his ass, don't come home crying," she said. "If you do, I'm going to beat your ass. Either way, you get an ass whooping. So who do you want it from?" I opened the door to my suite and followed the officers to a small room downstairs. The dormitory director was there with the boy and his parents. "Is this the guy?" the officer asked, pointing at me. "Yes, that's him," the boy responded. "Do you want to press charges?" the officer asked, seeming much too eager. The boy didn't respond. His mother looked at me. I expected anger, but there was none. "No, we don't want to press charges against him," she said softly. "That's okay." I looked at her with eyes that asked, "You don't?" I figured that's what they had come to do. Maybe she knew I would get kicked out of school if she pressed charges, and she didn't want to ruin my life. I don't know. But now the officer was telling me I was free to go. I wanted to thank her, but I was too shocked to speak. Her decision didn't end the matter, though. Because the incident had occurred on campus, I was summoned to appear before a board of university administrators who would decide my fate. The next day, my two white suite mates approached me. Sam and I had been cordial to them, but we mostly kept our distance. They said they had heard what happened and wanted to know if there was anything they could do to help. One of them said his father was a lawyer and could represent me if I needed. I thanked him for such a kind gesture, but I didn't really need an attorney. On the day of the hearing, I walked into the room, and about a half dozen administrators, mostly white men, sat around a long wooden table. One of them, a priest, with deep blue eyes and white hair, looked particularly sinister. The white boy was there, with his foot in a cast. His foot had slammed to the ground with such force that a bone had snapped. I was sure the administrators, after taking one look at him, would kick me out of school, no matter what I had to say. They called me to testify. I explained what happened and apologized to the guy I had hurt. I truly regretted what I had done. I presented supportive letters from one of my professors and Carla Dixon, who pleaded for mercy on my behalf. The administrators conferred with one another and announced their decision. They would give me another chance. They put me on probation for 6 months. If I got into any more trouble during that time, I would be expelled immediately. Silently, I thanked God. The mother's decision not to press charges against me had likely influenced the board. The compassion she displayed touches me still. It challenged the deep distrust I felt at the time toward white people. How could I continue to feel that way when this mother, who had every right to be angry that I had hurt her son, chose compassion instead? And when the administrators, who would have been justified in kicking me out, chose mercy? And when my suite mates, whom I avoided most of the time, offered their help? I was like, wow, there are some real cool white people in the world. I recognized that I needed to change. If I let my best friends down and blew this opportunity to get a college education, I could blame no one but myself. I prayed to God. Lord, I know I got to get my act together, 'cause sooner or later, you're gonna stop looking out for me. I'm glad God is patient, because before the end of my freshman year, I wound up in trouble again. Sam and I were in the room studying one day when some guys I knew stopped by for a visit. They were all dressed in Seton Hall sweatshirts and pants, and they bragged about how easy it was to steal them from the campus bookstore. I knew security in the store was lax, because earlier that year I had stolen a textbook I needed for class. I had run out of money, couldn't call home for help, and was feeling desperate. This time, greed was the motivation. I walked alone to the bookstore in the basement of one of the lecture halls and went straight to the rack where the sweatshirts were hanging. The store was empty except for the sales clerk behind the counter. There were a bunch of empty hangers and one large sweatshirt left. I scanned the store quickly with my eyes to make sure no one was watching me. Then I slipped the sweatshirt off the rack, stuck it under my shirt, and casually browsed around the store for several minutes. I thought about buying a pen or something cheap to lessen any possible suspicion, but I changed my mind at the last minute. As I passed the front counter on my way out, I felt the eyes of the sales clerk on me. "Excuse me," he said, in the most nasal, annoying tone. "What do you have under your shirt?" "What are you talking about?" I responded, trying to sound offended. "You have to come with me," he said. I couldn't believe this sales clerk, just another student, was challenging me. I took off running. "Hey, come back here," I thought I heard him say. I dashed up the basement steps and toward an open field. I was sure I had gotten away, but when I glanced behind me, I was shocked to see the clerk, a tall guy with long, lanky legs, following my trail. I pumped my legs harder, but I was quickly running out of breath. I made it to President's Hall, the administration building, pulled out the sweatshirt, and stashed it behind some bushes. At least if I got caught, I wouldn't have the stolen merchandise on me. I took off running again toward Bolin Hall. I glanced back, and the clerk was still chasing me. After about 10 minutes of running at full speed, I made it to my dorm. Another student was swiping his identification card to open the electronic doors. I rushed in behind him and ran down the hall to a friend's room. When she opened her door, I burst in and closed the door quickly behind me. "What's wrong?" she asked, startled. I told her I'd tell her later and asked if I could just sit for a while. I was too scared even to talk. Sweat dripped from my face like rain. I sat at my friend's desk, closed my eyes, and cradled my head in my hands. My conscience whipped me. I was still on probation. If the sales clerk found me, I would be kicked out of Seton Hall for sure. I had gambled with my future for a lousy sweatshirt. How could I be so stupid? There would be no more chances. Sam and George would have to go on without me. I kept waiting for the knock on the door. The clerk had chased me this far. I didn't think he would give up until he nabbed me. Surely someone had seen me slip into my friend's room. 45 minutes passed. I sent my friend into the hall to see if anyone was searching for me. Several people told her that a guy from the bookstore had been walking up and down the halls asking residents if they had seen anyone who fit my description, but he was gone. The hall was quiet. I needed some fresh air. I also still wanted that sweatshirt. Part of me felt crazily justified in trying to keep it since I had gone through such trouble to get it. I walked outside and headed back across the field to President's Hall. My stash was gone. The sales clerk must have found it and taken it back to the store. As I walked back to my dorm, I got the feeling that I had just used my last chance. My mind quickly crowded with thoughts. I couldn't keep risking everything. College was different from anything I had ever known, but I could get so much out of it if I just tried. I was making good grades, which meant I was smart enough to be here. All I had to do was stay out of trouble. If I got kicked out of college, where would I go? Back to Mom's house? That would surely break her heart. And what would happen to Sam and George? I thought about my old friends in Plainfield. Of the 10 of us, only 3 of us had even graduated from high school, and I was the only one in college. The walk back to my dorm seemed to take forever, but I was certain I grew up that day. I finally realized that if I wanted to change my life, I had to act differently. I stopped stealing. I worked extra hours. One summer, I even got a second job to help buy my books, school supplies, and personal items. Sam, George, and I borrowed from one another. And when that still wasn't enough, I just did without things I needed or wanted. When I told Sam and George what had happened, we laughed it off. Sam never said, "I told you so," though he had chosen to stay in the room when I left for the bookstore. By watching him and George, I began to see that I didn't have to act so tough to be cool, and I tried harder to control my temper. I can't say I was successful right away. I got into more fights, and I blew up more times than I would have liked. But with time and a conscious effort to think about the consequences before I responded, I slowly evolved into a different person. I rarely took time to read anything other than books assigned for class. But at a book sale my freshman year, one provocative title caught my eye, The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys. I bought the book. When I read it, I saw myself for the first time. I didn't realize then that the same book had inspired Carla, my college counselor. In it, Jawanza Kanjufu explains that many black boys turn to the streets to learn how to become men because they don't have fathers at home and no one steps in to fill the void. He discusses the importance of reaching black boys before they are hardened by the ways of the street and build a rap sheet the length of a football field. I knew firsthand that he was right, and I immediately wanted to help. All my life, I have been taught that black people have a responsibility to help each other out. I heard it when I followed my uncles to gatherings of the Nation of Islam, and Bill, the owner of the barbershop where I worked as a teenager, preached the same message. Bill owned a small, 3-chair shop that sat on Front Street, across from the Anchor Bar, the corner store, and Steve's record shop. He was in his 40s when I worked for him, and he fit the mold of the stereotypical barber, opinionated and quick to dispense advice. He and the other barbers kept the place packed with men of all ages who seemed to enjoy sitting around debating issues of the day as much as getting a haircut. The men engaged in typical barbershop banter about sports, women, and politics. But when the crowd left, and Bill and I prepared the shop for closing. I'd sweep up puddles of hair while Bill sat in the chair and pitched questions my way. Why did I think people in the neighborhood were so poor? What could I do to help? What did I think about God? What did the schools teach me about George Washington? Did I know he owned slaves? I was just 13, but Bill pushed me to question things and to think about issues I hadn't considered before. In high school, I even envisioned myself as an activist. But I never saw the dichotomy of that side of myself and the other side that stayed in trouble and did harmful things to people. I didn't think I was a bad person, but I kept doing bad things. When I read Kanjufu's book, I began to see myself more clearly, and I tried harder to change. I've always been a hyper, energetic person, so as soon as I read the book, I immediately wanted to act. I came up with an idea to start a mentoring program for kids in poor neighborhoods. I went to Sam and George. The three of us started brainstorming. We could recruit other volunteers, identify schools in Newark, and become mentors to the students there. We could even sponsor bus trips to bring students to Seton Hall so that they can see a college campus, perhaps for the first time. We wanted to do for children what we knew would have helped us. The three of us approached the Student Government Association, which ordains and finances official campus organizations. But the association was not eager to sanction a new group. The officers said we needed a faculty sponsor and a proposal before they could even consider our idea. They suggested we implement our program through an existing black organization. Nothing motivates Sam, George, and me more than being told no. We quickly found a sponsor, Professor Forrest Pritchett, the professor who headed the African American Studies Department. Then we sat down together and put our ideas into a proposal. But what would we call our organization? In his book, Kanjufu discusses the principles of Kwanzaa. One of them seemed to fit, Ujamaa, which in Swahili means collective work and responsibility. I suggested it to George and Sam. They loved it. We went back to the SGA. This time, the officers gave in, but they awarded us a measly $500. They said we had to raise whatever else we needed. I have to admit we were pissed. We had grandiose ideas, and we thought just maybe some folks on our campus didn't want a bunch of black kids from the inner city spending time at the university. That thought motivated us more. We set out to raise some money. During another brainstorm, we came up with a fundraising idea. We could throw a big party in the student union. We were an official campus organization, so we had access to the university's facilities free of charge. Since we always went to other nearby campuses to have fun because few parties at Seton Hall played black music, we figured we could charge the standard $5, advertise big, and draw students from the colleges and universities we frequented. I don't remember who came up with the theme for the party, but it was perfect, Ujamaa Jam. By then, George, Sam, and I were sophomores. We had never thrown a big party before, but we had been around enough to know that the DJ was the key to success. We needed somebody who knew just what to play and when. One of us remembered that a friend of ours from high school was dating a popular DJ around Newark. We called her, and she helped us book him at a discount rate. Next, Sam, George, and I used a computer to make flyers. Each of us took a bunch and drove to different campuses within an hour's drive, Rutgers, Drew, Fairleigh Dickinson, and others, to spread the news. We walked around handing our flyers to other students and placing them on car windows. We distributed at least 1,000 flyers. The problem with throwing a party like this, though, was that we had no idea until the night of the gig whether it would be a success. That night, three of us got there early to meet the DJ. We had asked other volunteers to collect money at the door because we had too many friends we knew would try to get in free if they saw one of us standing there. I watched the door all night, and within the first 2 hours, we had packed the house. After expenses, we cleared several hundred dollars. The party was such a success that we threw another one and sold soda and chips. We chose two elementary schools in Newark. George, Sam, and I recruited a few other students and began visiting the schools at the end of the day at least once a week to tutor students and talk to them about college. But when we approached the principals about busing the kids to campus, we got a lukewarm response and ultimately got bogged down in discussions about liability. We were just 19 years old when we planned our organization, so we naively thought that recruiting mentors and bringing kids to campus would be simple. We thought that other students would be knocking on our door to help and that public school officials would bend over backwards to provide kids with this opportunity. We learned really fast that we were wrong. We continued to mentor at the schools we had chosen, but it seemed that one of the biggest components of our organization, bringing kids to campus, had failed. Somehow, though, a teacher from a school in Brooklyn heard about our organization and contacted us. She wanted to bring a group of students from her school to campus. We were eager to work with her. The school itself busted students to campus and provided chaperones. Ujima bought lunch for all of the students and gave them a tour of the campus, and a few volunteers spoke to them about college life. Just seeing the excitement in the eyes of the kids as they explored the campus made me feel that I was doing something worthwhile. I can't remember ever feeling more proud of myself.
Giving back, Ramik.
I discovered early in my childhood that you don't need money or status to enrich another person's life. Anybody with passion and purpose can do so. Throughout my life, people have given generously of their time, skills, money, and more to help me succeed. They all had busy lives, and they didn't owe me a thing, yet they gave. I've always believed that much is required of those to whom much is given, so I've always felt compelled to give back. George Sam and I believe strongly that God protected us and lifted us up so that we could become examples to kids today, especially kids growing up in poor communities. That's why we started the mentoring program called Ujima in our freshman year of college, and more recently, the Three Doctors Foundation. The ways to give are as balanced as your creativity. Maybe you're a nurturer and can mentor a younger or less experienced colleague on the job. Maybe you're good with children and can spend an extra few hours a week reading or tutoring kids at your local elementary school. Or maybe you have the cash to send a kid in your neighborhood to a summer camp or to buy groceries for a poor family during the holidays. Giving is like playing a position on a football team. Everybody can't be the quarterback. You may be a better linebacker, wide receiver, or water boy. The important thing is that you find your position, whatever it is, and play hard. As a teenager, I lacked the one person in my life who could have made a difference earlier. A male mentor, a respectable father figure who would have been willing to spend time with me consistently, giving me advice and sharing fun things to keep me away from bad influences in my neighborhood. I believe that most boys, regardless of who they are or where they live, long for that kind of relationship with a father, a big brother, or even a stranger who steps in to fill the void. And that desire for male guidance stays with us from childhood. When our lives are taking shape to adulthood, when we are making crucial decisions about careers, life, and family. George always says that people should give, even if they are selfish, because there are selfish reasons to give. Your gift might touch the life of a child who otherwise might end up breaking into your house, jacking your car, or selling drugs to your child. Or your gift might help to raise the brain surgeon who someday saves your life. I'm not trying to scare anyone, but the point is that there's no excuse not to give, even if your reason is a selfish one. But there is another selfish reason to give. When you give to someone else, I found, surprisingly, that you often receive as well. In college, I discovered that when I went to elementary schools to tutor kids, I received as much as or more than the children did. We live in an age of excess, in which a person's value is attached to how much money he makes, what kind of car he drives, how many things have been acquired. But no monetary value can be placed on the feeling that comes when you know you've made a difference in another person's life. And all of us could use a boost in self-esteem, especially teenage boys, who can often be too macho to admit that they need a good pat on the back. And don't forget, when you touch another person's life, the gift keeps multiplying. Consider George's third grade teacher. She couldn't have known then that by making a difference in George's life, she someday would also make a difference in Sam's and mine.
Chapter 11. Rap. George.
Rap music defined our generation the way the Motown sound had defined our parents' era. We pumped up our music to get in the mood for studying and when we wanted to celebrate. We partied to rap music, we chilled to it, and in our freshman year, Ramik and I stumbled into the creative side of it. It started with a video game competition. After class, Ramik and I often teamed up against two guys from Boston to play video games, mostly Sega Genesis basketball. One day, we turned on some music and started rapping back and forth, the two of us against the two of them. We'd alternately make up rhymes on the spot that chopped up the other players or their hometown. It was all in fun to determine who could come up with the cleverest lyrics. Later on, Ramik and I challenged each other. "Man, I'm better than you," one of us would brag, and the contest began. Sometimes, we just rap back and forth to each other in the room before going out to a party on Thursday or Friday night. We even recorded a rap video once when a video company called Funflix came to Seton Hall as part of a campus fun day. The company set up a booth with the latest high-tech equipment and offered students a chance to make a music video for free. We could choose from a list of songs and lip-sync to a recording while the cameraman added a creative backdrop like stars. It was video karaoke. There were a few popular rap songs on the list, so Ramik and I got together with about five other friends and made several flicks. One of the guys with us that day was a seasoned rapper known around campus as PS. One night, Ramik and I were talking when one of us suggested that we try to hook up with PS to form a rap group. We approached him about it, and I was surprised that he agreed right away, because his skills were so far superior to ours. At first, we considered asking PS to write our lines, but we quickly realized that just wouldn't work. To feel what we were saying, each of us had to write our own lines. I became pretty good at coming up with metaphors, and Ramik developed great producer instincts. He was the one who pulled our individual pieces together into one good rap. We began by rapping over other groups' beats. Then Ramik started creating beats for us using a friend's sampler. Sampling was a popular technique in which musicians lifted a particular sound, say a horn solo or a drum beat, from a recorded song and piece it with other samples or original beats to create background music. We chose the name ART, Another Rough Tribe, for our group in the tradition of the colorful rappers whose sole purpose was to have fun stringing words together, showcasing their talents, and bragging about their exploits, particularly with women. We were big fans of rap pioneers like KRS-One and Rakim, and others like A Tribe Called Quest and Leaders of the New School, whose star Busta Rhymes broke away and became a popular solo rapper, sporting flashy, almost clownish costumes. We enjoy listening to all kinds of rap, especially socially conscious rap and even gangster rap, which ignited major controversy with its violent images and themes. We were just having fun in our spare time, unsure of how far we wanted to go with the group, but gradually, we got more serious. We asked Sam to be our manager. He is always more interested in working behind the scenes in rap and envisioned himself as more a business mogul, like Russell Simmons, or a producer like Sean Puffy Combs. The more we practiced, the better we got. We wanted to go into the studio to put together some original beats and record some songs, but we had no money. That's when a friend gave one of our tapes to her boyfriend, a Seton Hall basketball star who was being recruited to play in the NBA. An agent he knew owned a big studio in Newark, so he arranged for us to get some free studio time. We went to the studio at least once a week, sometimes more often, depending on our class schedules, and recorded a couple of rap songs. But after a while, the studio wanted to start charging us, so we had to come up with another plan. Sam came to our rescue. Always a penny pincher, Sam had some extra money from his savings over the years and decided to front us $500. Since all three of us were struggling financially, we recognized the huge sacrifice he was making. There was no guarantee that he would get his money back, and unlike me, he couldn't call home for help with his tuition when his money ran short. When I made it to college, my mother took on part-time jobs in addition to her full-time job at the insurance company and sent every dime of the extra money to me to help with tuition and books. She would have killed me if I had used even a penny of it to pursue a career as a rapper. But Sam understood our passion, believed in our talents, and decided to gamble. We found another studio owned by Kool & the Gang, a funk band popular in the 1970s, went in and recorded a couple more songs. We also heard that the Fugees, popular at the time with lead vocalist Lauryn Hill, had a studio in East Orange called the Booger Basement. When we stopped by, we hit it off with the cousin of Wyclef Jean, one of the band's founders. Wyclef's cousin ran the studio and told us he would put together some beats for us. We only had to pay for studio time. We used the Booger Basement to cut three more songs, which were even better than our first ones. Now we were ready to copyright our material, but we mistakenly thought we would have enough money to hire a lawyer. Ramit came up with an alternative, the so-called poor man's copyright. We typed the lyrics of our songs, and he sent a copy of them via certified mail to himself. When we had four or five songs on a demo tape, we decided to put together a package to send to record companies. We didn't have enough money for professional photos, so Ramit asked the guy who took pictures for the student newspaper to take a promotional photo of us. To look like real rappers, we had to appear tough, not like the college boys we had become. We scouted the campus for the perfect photo background. The green grass and stately trees surrounding Seton Hall just wouldn't do. Finally, we found the perfect spot, the upper deck of the student parking lot. The bare look of the concrete at night and the three of us in our baggy jeans, bad boy expressions, and hats flipped backward looked just about right. By now, we were in our junior year of college. We assembled 30 packets, each containing a copy of the demo, a promotional photo, and a short bio crafted by our wordsmith, P.S. Then, we used the telephone book and directory assistance to track down the addresses and telephone numbers of about 20 record companies. We were ready for New York. Ramit, P.S., and I skipped our classes and spent a day there, distributing our material. Ramit drove his white Volkswagen Golf, and each of us chipped in for gas and parking. We went from one record company to the next and handed our packet to the highest-ranking person available. A few times we were asked to drop our tape in a box with hundreds of others. One of the record companies on our list was Puffy's Bad Boy Records. Puffy had just started the label with a guy named Harv Pierre. Directory assistants had given us a Harlem address. But when we drove up, we didn't see any office buildings. The address was an apartment complex in the middle of the hood. For a moment, we sat perplexed in the car. What should we do? You don't just go walking up to some apartment in the hood without knowing where you're going. Anything could happen. But we had come this far, we weren't turning around. We found a telephone and called the number on our list. Sure enough, it was Bad Boy Records. We asked the person answering the telephone to confirm the address. He gave us an apartment number. We walked up to the door and rang the buzzer. A voice answered. "Is this Bad Boy Records?" one of us asked. "Yeah, come on up." We felt a bit awkward when we first walked into the apartment because a bunch of guys were just sitting around. We looked around the room. No Puffy. "What do you need?" one of the guys asked. We explained that we were rappers and wanted Puffy to listen to our tape. We figured we had a better chance of getting called back if we could get Puffy to listen to it on the spot. Puffy wasn't there, but we were directed to a bedroom where Harv Pierre, Puffy's vice president, sat on a king-size bed surrounded by at least 300 tapes. Three different phones sat on the bed next to him, and he had one at each ear. He looked up and saw us. "Can I help y'all? What do you need?" With each of us speaking at different times, we told him we were rappers, that we were in college at Seton Hall, and we really wanted him to listen to our tape. "That's cool, man, that's dope," he responded with a friendliness that immediately put us at ease. He chatted with us for about 5 minutes, but he said he was too busy to listen to the tape right then. He asked us to put it in his pile, and he promised to call us back. We left feeling super hyped. We were sure we would hear from Bad Boy Records. Puffy was just getting started and surely must have been looking for new artists like us. But the telephone call from Bad Boy Records never came. We didn't get even one response from the 20 packets we distributed. We kept trying. We started getting weekend gigs. Our first big performance was at a nightclub about 15 minutes from Seton Hall. It was a hip-hop club that drew a young adult crowd, mostly college students of all races, who came to dance and watch live performances. When we made it to the club the night of our gig, customers were lined up outside the door to get in. As VIPs, we bypassed the crowd. That made us feel important. We did a sound check, gave the disc jockey our instrumental tape, and chilled in the back of the club near the bar until it was time to go on stage. We were the opening act. "What's up, y'all? How y'all doing out there?" Ramik yelled into the microphone as the crowd gathered around the makeshift stage. He introduced himself, then me, then PS by our stage names. "I'm the old veteran, this is Soundseeker, and this is OZ the Wizard. And we're another rough tribe. All right, DJ, drop that beat." The bass began pounding, and we were into our first song, getting the crowd hyped and dancing to our beat. "Yo, check it out, check it out, check it out." Bodies bounced in rhythm, and dozens of white, yellow, brown, and black hands pumped in the air. They loved us. "Aw, man, y'all are dope. When's your CD coming out?" one person after another asked afterward. For the moment, we were hot and loving it. I gave one of our packets to Faith Evans, my friend from elementary school. Through her, Ramik, Sam, and I met some of the guys who would become rap megastars. One of them was Biggie Smalls, also known as the Notorious B.I.G., whom Faith had married in 1994, just days after they met at a photo shoot for Bad Boy Records. For a while, she lived in East Orange and sometimes invited me to her house with them for Sunday dinner. Biggie was a huge dude who must have weighed more than 300 pounds. I'll never forget the image of him seated in the kitchen table with a mound of chicken bones piled high on his plate. He had devoured the fried chicken at record speed. Faith was the first female artist signed by Bad Boy Records in 1994, and I went to the recording studio with her every chance I got while she was working on her first album. I'd sit on the floor while Faith recorded in the booth. Puffy, Biggie, and other stars would be in and out all the time. Everybody was down to earth, just regular people back then. Once, Faith invited Sam, Ramik, and me to a photo shoot at Bad Boy Records. The three of us were rolling dice in a small bathroom when Biggie walked in and put up $100. He lost it to Sam in a game called CeeLo. Biggie put up another $100 and lost that too. He kept betting until he owed Sam more than $3,000. Few guys could roll better than Sam. They kept playing until he won all but $400 of it back. But $400 was a big deal to a broke college student. Biggie and Puffy raised the profile of rap on the East Coast, especially in New York City. Biggie had been a crack dealer in Brooklyn, and he crafted complex rhymes with lurid lyrics that painted vivid images of the realities of inner city life. The harshness of it, but also the glitzy style that came to be known as Ghetto Fabulous. Some of his lyrics were disrespectful to women, but mostly Biggie just wanted to make you feel good and tell you how he was loving life. When you listened to him, you were living the glamorous life through him. At the same time, Biggie's West Coast rival, Tupac Shakur, was also selling millions of records with more introspective and poetic lyrics that delved into the life and soul of the gangster. Even if you weren't from the inner city, if you listened to Tupac, you got the feeling that the thugs have more heart than you thought. He reached into himself and tried to interpret where a lot of the negative behavior came from, and he crafted his lyrics in a way that you could really understand. I knew the world they rapped about, and I was a fan of both rappers. But their rivalry ultimately escalated into an East Coast, West Coast feud that some say took the lives of rap's two top stars. Tupac was shot to death on September 7, 1996, in a drive-by shooting in Las Vegas. 6 months later, Biggie was gunned down as he left an after-party for the Soul Train Music Awards. The attackers were never identified in either shooting. I was hoping tensions would cool after Tupac's death, so when Biggie died less than a year later in almost the same way, I was shocked. My phone rang off the hook with friends calling to mourn as if a blood brother had just been murdered. Big, tough dudes in my old neighborhood were walking around dazed. I was sure the anti-rap forces would find a way to put more pressure on the rap industry and just shut it down. Critics were already blaming rap for glorifying and perpetuating the violence in communities like the ones where Sam, Ramik, and I grew up. By the time Biggie was killed, Rameek and I had already made a major decision about our career as rappers. When we gave the tape to Faith in 1994, our junior year in college, she passed it on to her lawyer, who sent it to Dennis Scott, an NBA player who was with the Orlando Magic. He owned a company called 3D Entertainment, which managed a couple of rap groups. Apparently, he liked one of our songs, and he sent us a letter saying he wanted to hear more. The problem was, we were flat broke. We didn't have the resources to go back into the studio and record. Rameek was so excited about our chances of succeeding as rappers that he wanted to put everything into making this dream happen. He was even willing to skip medical school. He figured the three of us would still be together, just pursuing a different dream. But the life of a rapper was his dream, not ours. He loved the stage, the spotlight, and the cheers from the crowd. It was part of his fantasy of becoming an actor. To him, being a rapper was the next best thing. We had good connections, and he figured we could count on them for help. And if things didn't work out, we could always return to school. I wasn't feeling the same way. Graduation from college was less than a year away, and we had to start applying to dental and medical schools. We had to make a crucial decision. One night, the subject came up during conversation. "Yo, man, we can really do this," Rameek began. "Let's just do it. Let's go and be rappers." It was time for me to be honest. My enthusiasm was waning. I knew that if I gave my books enough time, I was guaranteed to become a dentist. But I can go into the studio a million times, and no matter how good the songs were, I wasn't guaranteed to sell those records. With rap, it really came down to luck. Maybe we would be some of the lucky ones, but I wasn't willing to take that risk. "Look how many broke rappers are out there, man," I said to Rameek. "One day they're big and hot with the biggest studio, and the next day they're not. Man, you're on your way to medical school. You want to drop medical school for this? I'm on my way to dental school. I'm not dropping dental school for this. You're crazy." "Come on, man, you're stupid, man. Let's just try. Let's just see what happens," Rameek shot back. I didn't budge. "Nah, man, I'm not even gonna see. At some point, we still have to make a decision, and I've already made mine." Rameek got quiet. I had just spewed acid on his fantasy, and it was shriveling up before his eyes. He didn't want to try it alone, and P.S., our other partner, had already drifted away. P.S. was a brilliant student, as talented in math as he was in rap, but he didn't try hard at either one and ended up dropping out of Seton Hall. After a few minutes of silence, Rameek looked at me. I wasn't sure what he would say. "You know what, man?" he said softly. "You're right." That was it. Our career as rappers came to an abrupt halt. Our pack was still solid. Once again, we were on our way to becoming doctors.
Chapter 12. Lovesick, Rameek.
I always thought I was too cool to let a girl break my heart. Then I met the woman I'll call Kay. She was standing next to a friend of mine from high school after a party at Rutgers University in New Brunswick when I spotted her. She was so fine, on the tall side, with golden brown skin, shoulder-length dark brown hair, innocent eyes, and a tempting smile. "Who's your friend?" I asked my high school friend. So she introduced me to Kay and told her flattering things about me. Kay was a freshman at Rutgers University and was 2 years younger, but the chemistry between us was instant and powerful. She gave me her telephone number. When I called her the next day, we talked for nearly 5 hours straight. From South Orange to New Brunswick was a long-distance call, so I rang up a huge telephone bill those first few weeks as Kay and I got to know each other. She and I started hanging out together regularly. Sometimes we double-dated or triple-dated with Sam, George, and their dates. All of us would go out to dinner, to party, or bowling. Once, the six of us even went ice skating in New York City's Rockefeller Center. When George, Sam, or I had a girlfriend, she automatically became part of our group, like a little sister to the other two of us, and she was off-limits as a potential date. That's why we never had a conflict over a girl. In the first few years of college, Sam and I played the field more than George, who more often than not had a steady girlfriend. Even though I played the round, I always knew I wanted to get married and have children after college. I wanted to have the perfect family I had always hoped for as a kid. I didn't want to ever inflict the insecurity of a broken home like the childhood I had on a child. I tried to be careful. I couldn't have any baby mama drama disrupting my dreams. Things got serious pretty quickly between Kay and me, and we often talked about getting married and having kids together someday. I thought she was the one. But one night, while I was visiting her in her dorm room at Rutgers, her telephone kept ringing. She seemed uneasy when she answered it and gave one-word answers, yes or no, and then, I'll have to talk to you later. Who was that? I asked. She wasn't in the mood for my questions. We argued about it, and I left. Later that night over the telephone, she told me the truth. She had another boyfriend. He was a football jock who attended college in Boston. He had been her high school sweetheart, and though she didn't want to be with him anymore, she hadn't quite broken things off. I was crushed. How could I ever trust her? How could she do this to me? How could she do this to us? I broke up with her. I was miserable for a few weeks until we got back together. She promised me that the guy was out of her life for good, but the trust issue kept coming up. If she wasn't in her room when I called, I questioned her extensively. If she ignored her telephone when I was there, I got suspicious, and I felt justified. She knew she had to earn my trust again, and for a while she did all she could. She stayed in her room all day instead of hanging out with her friends, just to prove to me that there was no other man in her life. She wanted me to trust her, but the questions and suspicions lingered. We broke up and got back together a million times. When we split, just before my senior year, it seemed like all the other times. I figured we would take some time to cool off, and then in a week or two we would be a couple again. But I didn't realize that she had taken all she would take of my lack of trust. We were done, she kept telling me. At first I didn't believe her. Then I started hearing rumors that she was dating someone else. I confronted her. It was true. My girl had moved on without me. The guy she was dating was a legendary player. Everybody knew it. He had dated practically all of the pretty girls on Rutgers campus, and all the others wanted him. Maybe it gave Kay's ego a boost to be with him. But that's when it hit me that I could lose her for good. I had heard of the term lovesick, and I figured it was something that happened to girls. Certainly not a tough guy like me. But all of a sudden, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I lost weight. I started calling Kay a dozen times a day, trying to change her mind. I knew her new boyfriend didn't care for her the way I did. I loved this girl. I wanted to marry her. I wanted to have kids with her. I had to get her back. During one of those sleepless nights, a plan crystallized in my mind. Kay was the kind of woman who needed to be with her man all the time. I knew that once I began medical school, the workload would be so demanding that I wouldn't have time for her. Then after medical school, I'd have to do a residency, which would keep me even busier. I would be nearly 30 years old before I had time for a wife and kids. At 21, that seemed ancient. I decided I would just forget about medical school, marry Kay, and start our perfect family. I knew I could get a job teaching. Sam and I had arranged our schedules that semester to have a day off on which we would work as substitute teachers. I worked at a high school and elementary school in a community called Hillside. The principal of the elementary school had approached me one day and asked me my major. Biology, I told him. We need teachers, he said. You're a young black man about to get a degree in biology. I have a job waiting for you when you finish. I wondered how I would tell Sam and George that I was about to break the pact. We had promised to stick together to the end, but I figured they would be all right without me. I figured they would understand. I had to live my own life. I called Kay and asked to see her. She refused. I told her I loved her and needed her in my life. Then she told me what I had been dreading to hear. She was falling for the other guy. She wanted to try to make it work with him, and nothing I said could change her mind. I never even got to tell her about my plan. I was lovesick for months. I'm sure Sam and George noticed. But guys are proud. We don't even let our closest boys know if our heart is hurting. Nah, dog, I'm straight, I said when they asked about the weight loss. I never told Sam and George about my plan either. With my heart in pieces, I began preparing again for medical school.